All right, we're going to get started. We got a lot of material today, so we're going to get started and people will trickle in. That's okay. So last week, we finished by looking at Jesus' tomb. And when we looked at Jesus, or not Jesus' tomb, we looked at the leper's tomb. You guys remember we took some time looking at that tomb where this leper was. And I wanted to do that so you guys could get a feel for what Jesus' tomb would have been like. And Craig Evans is the man in this video. He's a biblical scholar and archaeologist, and he's going to share a little bit about how Jesus' tomb would have been. So there's a video right now he's going to show to kind of segue from last week to this week. Go ahead.
Jesus would have been placed in a tomb like this. The Gospels tell us it belonged to Joseph of Arimathea. In fact, it was a new tomb, and that's a very significant point that he makes, because Jesus died the death of a criminal. And therefore, according to Jewish law and custom, his body could not be placed in a tomb of honor. Of course, the mercy of Joseph is that Jesus' body was not placed in a tomb of dishonor because it had never been used before. In a sense, it was neutral. It's a very important point to keep in mind. Now, his body would have been laid in after being washed, wrapped, perfumed. His body would have been placed in a chamber like this, but not just out here in the anteroom, but inside a niche like this. Over here on my right, you can actually see a ledge inside this niche. This is a very large niche for receiving bodies. So it would have been placed in a niche like this. Now the expectation, of course, would have been for family, disciples, loved ones to come back to this tomb 1 year later, and the Jewish law allowed that. After a person had been executed as a criminal, 1 year later, it's sort of like all is forgiven, and the bones now can be gathered up and can be placed in a place of honor, the family tomb, presumably, something like that. Perhaps the bones would be placed in a niche within the family tomb or placed in an ossuary. And then the ossuary would be placed into a niche, not too different from that. Now, the expectation, of course, would be that for 7 days, people would come to the tomb where Jesus had been buried. They would pray. They would perhaps even anoint his body further to mask the smell of decomposition. And after 7 days, the funeral then would be over. This is why the Gospels relate that when the women came to the tomb, the first opportunity, Jesus having died Friday night, all day Saturday, Sabbath, had never come to a cemetery at night, so Sunday morning is the first opportunity for the women to come to the tomb of Jesus. Well, there'd have been a large stone to pull out of the way. They're wondering who will help us. And so they come to the tomb, and to their surprise, they find that the large stone is gone, and they step into an anteroom, probably like this, and they would have looked toward the niche where they knew, where they had observed that the body of Jesus had been placed, and the body was not there. They may have assumed that the body had been moved, perhaps by the authorities, who did not approve of Joseph Arimathea's decision to place the body of Jesus in a neutral spot. Who knows what they were thinking? They had been very worried, because there's a Jewish tradition that says, after 3 days of death, the face cannot be recognized. They may well have thought that the body of Jesus had been taken out of this neutral tomb and would have been added to the two other men who had been crucified in a common grave, a dishonorable grave. And then they wouldn't be able to recognize Jesus. Sunday was the third day. Monday could well be too late. So there they were pondering the significance of this. Now, John's Gospel adds that when the disciples came, having heard from the women, they actually found the grave clothes. And that would mean they would look into a niche like this where the body of Jesus was supposed to be, and the body was gone, leaving behind just the shroud, the face wrapping, and other wrappings. And this would, of course, just astounded them, because after all, if the body had been moved and taken to a new location, it would not have been unwrapped. So it's these kinds of details, the actual physical tomb itself, the niches, ossuaries, and all of that, stones, doors, and so forth, we need to know in order to fully appreciate the Easter accounts that we have in the four Gospels. We need to know these kinds of details. And I think then we can appreciate the verisimilitude, the veracity, the accuracy of the Gospels. They were telling it like it is. And the women, of course, were puzzled. The disciples were puzzled. But their wonderment, their puzzlement, was all brought to an end when they met the risen Jesus himself.
All right. So, I hope that gives you a feel for what Jesus' tomb would have been like. And obviously, we know Jesus didn't stay in the tomb. And there's a sheet in your binder that has some of the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. But very briefly, I just wanted to mention, there's four facts that pretty much every historian who's studied this agrees is true. One, Jesus was crucified and buried in a tomb, of Joseph of Arimathea. Two, his tomb was found empty by a group of his women followers. Three, the disciples experienced appearances of the risen Jesus after his death. This is non-Christian scholars will say, yes, we think that they had some sort of experience. We don't know what it was. We don't know what it was like. We're not going to tell it, but we think they had some sort of experience. And finally, the original disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe that Jesus had risen from the dead, so much that they were willing to die for that belief. So I think that is overwhelming evidence for the truthfulness of the resurrection of Jesus. And one thing you'll see, there's this sheet that I handed out last week. There's more right there called a harmonistic overview of the resurrection narratives. And you can look at that. When you read the resurrection narratives side by side, what you notice is the details of those events don't easily line up. And that actually, I think, is a compelling reason for the truthfulness of them. Because as you know, if a detective it has a group of witnesses to a crime, they separate them immediately. And the reason why is because if they're in the same room, their stories all start to line up. They start to tell things in the same order. They start to remember the same facts. It all starts to line up. And we don't see this evidence of the gospel writers trying to harmonize the accounts of the resurrection of Jesus. So we see different perspectives of the resurrection that are yet compatible with each other. And so this is an attempt to synthesize an overview of the resurrection narratives that I think makes sense. And when you look at this, you'll see the different places where Jesus appeared to the disciples. Several of the appearances were in Jerusalem in the upper room. And then there's in Jerusalem near the tomb to the women. We have on the road to Emmaus, Jesus appeared to a couple of disciples there. Then when Jesus did appear in Matthew, it tells us that when in Jerusalem, he told the women, go to Galilee. You'll see me in Galilee. Go to Galilee. He says that multiple times. And so the disciples would have went up to Galilee, obeying Jesus' directions. And he said, you'll see me on the mountain in Galilee. And so some people think that's Mount Tabor, taking Galilee as more of this region. Some people think it's Mount Arbel, which takes Galilee as more of the Sea of Galilee, the area where Jesus ministered more frequently. I take it as Mount Arbel, personally, just because I think that's closer to where Jesus would have ministered, and he probably had met with them there before. So when he said the mountain, they probably thought, oh, the mountain. We know what he's talking about. So that's up here towards the Sea of Galilee. So Jesus appeared to seven disciples while fishing or along the coast of Galilee. And then he appears to the 11 in Galilee. And then apparently the disciples go back to Jerusalem. And in Acts 1, we read that Jesus tells them to stay there in Jerusalem. And he appears to them in Jerusalem and then again in Bethany. And in Bethany is where he ascends. And if you go to Bethany today, there's a footprint of where Jesus is. Just kidding. There is a footprint, but it's not the exact spot. Nobody knows the exact spot, but traditionally that's the spot. So there's also various other locations where Jesus appeared risen from the dead. And one last thing I want to say about Jesus' resurrection is that we don't have a comprehensive account of all of his appearances. Acts 1 tells us that he presented himself alive to them after suffering many proofs, appearing to them during 40 days and speaking about the kingdom of God. So that's a little over a month that Jesus was appearing to these guys and walking with them and eating with them and talking with them. They preserved some of the more memorable accounts, some of the more important accounts, but Jesus appeared to them over the period of a month. So we don't have a full record of all of those appearances. So that's Jesus' resurrection. We serve a risen king. Amen. Now Dave is going to cover about 2,000 years of church history.
Right. So I got 44 minutes to do 2,000 years, so no problem. So guys, just really appreciated Nathaniel the last 5 weeks teaching us through the life of Jesus, and I've learned a ton of stuff. So like I said, 2,000 years, 44 minutes, so if you like drinking water, it's going to be coming from a fire hose, so here we go. So the year is 70 AD. We're going to kind of speed up to 70 AD. It's been about 37-ish years since Jesus has ascended. We know for a fact, the only disciple for a fact that we know is alive still is John, and he's imprisoned in the island of Patmos right now. If you ever want to know about that, I know the Connors have gone, they got some great information about that, but that's where we know the book of Revelation, we'll be speaking about next week, is written sometime in the 90s. Possibly the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John might have not been written as well. But we think that most of all the disciples at this time have probably been martyred. So the Old Testament's already been written, obviously, and now all of the New Testament as well. Well, Rome is the most powerful empire at this time period right now. It was anytime you talk about great civilizations or great empire, Rome is always on the top. It wasn't the biggest. It wasn't the longest lasting. Does anyone guess, and Tom, you can't give this answer. Does anyone guess who the longest lasting empire or the largest empire ever was? It's the British Empire, right? It's crazy. Like, literally, our known world, they owned about 23% of the known world at one time. The sun rose and set over the British Empire. Well, this was the height of the empire, about 117 AD, and it had about 25% of the known world's population at its time. The thing that made, depending on how you measure Rome's time period, you have anywhere between 1,500 years and 2,000 years. If you go with the 1,500 years, that's when the Roman Empire or the Republic starts. 2,000 years would be where we'd get to these two guys, Romulus and Remus. They're raised by wolves. They're raised by wolves, you know, so we're all adults here. April 21st, 753 BC is when this legend begins, and Remus actually is killed by his brother Romulus, and that's how we get the name Rome. Well, Rome grew initially in size and strength through trade. They were fantastic at being able to get other cultures and other ideas from other empires, and they built upon that. This allowed Rome to go rapidly, and they became a trading town at first, but then they prospered into a great empire, but mostly through war. Rome was the greatest army that the world had ever seen at this time. It was the backbone of their civilization. They would have to march 20 to 30 miles a day, carrying all their own equipment. They had brutal discipline. Beatings were common. All the tactics that they used, all the military technology they had, again, they made it better. Everything from their helmets that were taken from the Greeks, to their swords, to their armor, their shields, everything had been duplicated and made better. The only thing that's actually unique to the Romans is their spear, and even then, it was the best spear of its time, because when they would throw it, it had a soft iron tip, so if it didn't hit anything, it would bend, and then they weren't able to throw it back. So the Romans were just fantastic about that. But brutal training, what was demanded. In fact, many senators, they would brag about their time serving in the army, and they'd rip their cloaks and say, I was once a great warrior. But the discipline, as I would continue to talk about, was brutal. And I'll give you an example. There was something called, gotta find it here. Dissemination. And basically what that was, if you dishonored or you disobeyed an order during battle, they would take you back and they would draw lots. Out of every 10 men, you would draw a lot. And the person that lost that lot, the other 9 men would beat that person to death. So if you had 100, you lost 10, 1,000, you lost 100, and so on and so forth. So discipline and following orders was mandated. Well, the army was also brutal to their enemies. There are stories of the Gallics, and they were, or the Gauls, and what they were is early on in Roman history, you actually had this group come down to Rome and actually take over Rome. And the Romans actually had to bribe them with gold for them to leave. Well, the Romans didn't forget this. And when the Romans became the empire of the time, they said, okay, we'll surrender. We'll assimilate into your culture. And the Romans said, nope. And they went and killed hundreds of thousands and even up to a million of these people. And there's accounts of farmers saying that they had great harvests for years because of all the blood and the bone that had been spent in the soil. Well, they were also great builders. Romans were fantastic builders, and they brought roads. This was the first empire that actually brought roads across their whole entire empire. They brought aqueducts and water. They brought theaters and baths, and we're going to be seeing two Roman ancient civilizations. One is Bethshin. That's an ancient civilization. It had been built many, many times. This is where King Saul, remember, was killed, and he was pinned to the wall. Well, that was the ancient part of Bethshin. Well, when the Romans got there, like, well, we're not going to build on this old stuff. We're going to build a brand new one. And it was one of the greatest of the 10 cities. And it was the greatest of those 10 cities. It was actually destroyed in an earthquake, but we'll see that. And then we're going to see Caesarea Maritima. Remember that? King Herod, that's on the Mediterranean coast. We'll see that as well. So they were fantastic builders. Well, Rome really only had three rules. It was pay your taxes. Jesus addressed that. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar, unto God, unto God. They kind of let you worship when you wanted to worship, except when they would make the emperor God, and then you would have to worship them, and that's why the Christians struggled with that so much. And then the last thing was don't revolt. Those were kind of the three rules. We'll let you have all our culture. We'll let you do what you want to do, but don't do those three things, or we're going to come get you. And that's what brings us to the time period of 70 AD. So in 66 AD, you have the Jewish-Roman War begins. And what basically happens here is a general named Vespasian, this is him here, he sent down the northern part of Galilee, and he begins to go down and crush this rebellion. And he was not merciful to any of these people. In fact, the people knew they were coming not by seeing the Romans march, but by the blood and the bodies that were coming down the Jordan River. And he began to squash all this rebellion. But this is also the time period where Nero, if you remember Nero, he's the mad emperor. He's the one that used to crucify Christians and burn them in his gardens during parties. He's the one that started the fire of Rome, and he played his fiddle. Well, he committed suicide, and there's an unstable time in Rome. So Vespasian is sent back to stabilize this. And he leaves his favorite general, who happens to be his son, Titus, in charge. Now, Titus continues to systematically crush the rebellion, and he enslaves and kills hundreds of thousands of Jews. And finally, he turns his attention to the crown jewel of Jerusalem, that city of Jerusalem. Now, during this time in Jerusalem, it was a fortified city, so there was a lot of people that were hiding in that city. Also, it was Passover, so lots of pilgrims were coming into Jerusalem, but no one was being allowed out. So they set siege to the city, they cut off all the supplies, and nobody could come out. And what would happen is any of the Jewish people that wanted to escape, they're being captured. And they're being crucified hundreds at a time in plain view of the city. Now, it's kind of gross, but what happens is they're being crucified. There's so many crosses that they say there's no more trees to be cut down. And they're hanging on these crosses, and sometimes it would take days. So the Romans would stake the other people out, basically, until these people died, and then they would put them up on the cross. Well, these bodies, and this is kind of gross, but as they deteriorated and expand and explode, they start finding that there's jewels and coins in these bodies. So now the Romans actually disembowel some of the people to get these treasures out before they're even crucified. So it's a horrific time. Josephus, if you remember, he was a historian, a Jewish historian. He was actually part of the rebellion. He's wounded and he's captured by the Romans, and he becomes a historian for the Romans. He talks about how horrific the conditions are in Jerusalem, that there's actually cannibalism going on during this revolt. Well, again, the city's put under total siege, and Titus turns his four legions against the city, and they begin to break through these walls. And they break through the first set of walls, and they're pushed back, and weeks later they break through the second city walls, and they're pushed back, till finally they get to the northern part of the city of Jerusalem, and they get to the fortress of Antonio. And that's this fortress here. It was a Roman fortress. Basically, they demolished this fortress here to build a large ramp siege to get into Jerusalem. And once they break through, it's just utter chaos. And these soldiers go through and just start massacring men, women, and children. And they just kill all of them. And there's two views of how this temple, the great temple of of the Jerusalem is started on fire. There's one that was a stray arrow that kind of went, and because they had said don't destroy the temple because they wanted to keep that. So that's one view. Another view is some of these soldiers were also mercenaries, and they weren't as trained as the other Roman soldiers. And there's a story possibly that a torch was thrown into the temple and it begins this fire, and it just just melts everything into this temple. Well, Josephus actually says that they were so angry, these soldiers, that after they'd slaughtered everyone, that they turned their aggressions to the foundation of the city. And this is where the gold and the silver possibly would have melted in between the stones of the temple. And this is where we fulfill the prophecy of Jesus that no stone would be left unturned on the Temple Mount. But it wasn't just the Temple Mount. The Romans destroyed all of Jerusalem. They knocked down all the walls, all the city. They absolutely destroyed it. In fact, they renamed Jerusalem after they conquered it. It was so destroyed. Well, the destruction of Jerusalem changes everything about the way that the Jewish people worship. There was no more temple to worship. In fact, there were some things, though, that Titus took out of the temple. That he took out a solid gold menorah. He took out some silver trumpets. He took out this table of showbread. All these things, except for the trumpets, would have been mentioned in the Old Testament during the time of the tabernacle. Remember, we had the Ark of the Covenant. We had the table of showbread, other items, and the menorah. And after the destruction of Israel, they actually minted some coins here, which means conqueror of Judea. And some scholars believe that some of the items taken out of the temple might have been melted down to make these coins. Now, they can't prove that, but can you imagine how valuable those coins would be if we knew it was actually from the temple? Well, Titus returns to Rome, and he actually becomes emperor as well. And he dies at about 2 years later under suspicious circumstances, and his brother becomes the new emperor. And he's probably the one that's in charge of those suspicious circumstances. Well, his brother's not very popular with the people of Rome, so he builds something called the Arch of Titus. Now, the Arch of Titus, for those of you going to Rome or have been to Rome, a lot of people kind of just walk by it, don't pay much attention. It's kind of on the way to the Colosseum. But when you do get to this, pay close attention, because on this, you see the destruction of Jerusalem, and you see the items that have been taken out. So here's a pagan people that could care less about the Jewish people and their religion, showing that what actually occurred in Jerusalem. You have the menorah, the table of showbread, and you have these silver trumpets. Well, when we're down in the archaeological southern steps that where Jesus would have gone into the temple, we're going to see a couple things there. So one of the things we're going to see is this. This is the inscription. Nathaniel talked about this when he went to the temple. This is where it warned the pagans or the Gentiles not to go any further into the outer courts. So that was found there, and this is in the Museum of Israel. Perhaps we'll be able to see that if we get to go to that museum. And as well as this right here, which is really interesting. Now you can see this is called the trumpet stone. You can see it's almost like a corner. Well, it was on the top of the temple. And this is where the priests would go and blow the trumpets to signal the beginning of Shabbat or the Sabbath and then also end it. Well, you can see how it's broken off right here. Well, because that's the fake piece. The real piece, again, is in the Museum of Israel. So hopefully we can see that as well. Well, these are all items that are in the temple, in the Museum of Israel that we might see. So what about the Western Wall? So when we talk about, no stone would be left unturned, well, how does that relate when we have this huge wall? Well, it shouldn't be called the Western Wall. I'm okay with the Wailing Wall, because the Wailing Wall is where you see the Jews and you see them rocking back and forth. They're praying for their Messiah. I wish they were praying for the return of their Messiah, but right now they're praying for their Messiah. So they're like, well, how are all these stones still here? Well, it should be called the Rest and Retaining Wall, because this wall was just a wall to hold up the dirt mound that the temple where the Dome of the Rock is now. It's much longer than this. This is the most holy place for the Jewish faith. It's much longer, and it's also much higher. So we're actually going to be going down to the Western Wall tunnels, and here we're going to see a stone that's as big as a bus. I forgot how deep it is, but it's like they still do not know how they were able to get this stone in place here. Also on this, we're actually going to get to a place where the Jewish people believe is the closest place they can get to where the holies of holies would have been above them. So we'll see this during our tour as well. Well, Masada, as Nathaniel talked about, is kind of the end of the rebellion of the Jewish people in 72 AD. And if you remember, King Herod's the one who built this. and it was not easily accessible. This is out by the Dead Sea. It was not easily accessible. The only on the other side of this is called the Snake Trail, and it was very well fortified, so you couldn't send one soldier at a time up there, or they'd just be, you know, killed. So in Roman style, they get a bunch of slaves, and they actually, bucket by bucket, this is not a natural formation, they build this ramp all the way up to the top of Masada. I got to find a way to walk up that, or at least down it, but we're going to be on the other side, so I don't know if I'll make the bus back in time, but either way, I'd love to do that. But that's literally made by man with no tractors. This is bucket by bucket. And if we remember when they get to the top, if we remember the story that Nathaniel told us, that they had all committed suicide, and there was just a couple women and some children that survived and tell this story. So we'll be traveling there as well. So that's the end of the Jewish rebellion. There's some interesting facts in your binder about where the disciples ended, also about Masada, also about the destruction of Jerusalem. So take a look at that as well. Well, the Western Roman Empire falls in 476 AD. And let me just talk about AD and BC real quick, and BCE and CE, because when you're there, you're going to see all these letters, you're going to be like, what does this mean? So when I was growing up, you had BC, which was before Christ, and you had AD, which means the year of our Lord, or I would say after death. Well, if you see now in a lot of our texts, you see BCE and you see CE. So it's not before Christ anymore. Now it's before the common era. And now instead of AD, after death, or the year of our Lord, we have CE, which is the common era. So you can see how secular our calendars changed after Christ, but I guess we don't recognize that anymore. So just so you know, when you're seeing things, what those mean. Well, again, the Roman Western falls in 476, but it continues on now renamed as the Byzantine Empire, and that's the eastern side of the empire, and that lasts from 1095 to 1291 AD. And this is the time of the Crusades. So the Crusades are basically, depending on religion, first of all, depending on what you think just is, depending on what you think right and wrong is, depending on a lot of things, and we're not going to go through all of them, but there were 9 Crusades. And here's a picture of the Crusades. This is the Dome of the Rock. And basically what you had is you had popes and you had kings that were sending, I'll say, you know, banners of armies under the Christian flag down to Jerusalem to retake the land from the Medes or the Arabs or the Muslims. And then after they were pushed out again, you had the Arabs and the Muslims or the Medes come back and conquer. And this is where we get the Crusader church built and then the mosque built on top of that and on top of that. But here's the thing that's common. You have Christians on the way down to kill Muslims to take over Jerusalem. And you have Muslims on the way back to take over Jerusalem to kill Christians. And both Christians and Muslims on the way there stop to kill Jews. So they're killing Jews than their own land because they're persecuted people. So there's more to it than that, of course, with the Crusades, but that's as much as probably we'll be able to cover during that time. Well, the 1453 AD, the Byzantine Empire falls, and for the next several hundred years, this area of Judea, of Palestine, of Israel, is ruled by a bunch of different kings and kingdoms and empires. You have the Egyptians that return for a while. You have the Arabs. You have the Turks. A bunch of different ones come, but the next main one that we'll actually be familiar with is the Ottoman Empire, and we'll be familiar with it because there's things that were made there by the Ottoman Empire that we'll see. Well, the early Ottoman Empire was from 1517 all the way to 1917. So finally, we're like, oh, 1917, like my grandma was alive during that time, right? So we can start seeing where we are in time. Well, early on in the Ottoman Empire, it was actually a relatively very peaceful time in Jerusalem. You had synagogues where the Jewish people would celebrate Sabbath. You had Christian churches or the Crusader churches where they would be able to celebrate. You had mosques where Muslims celebrate. And they were sometimes on the same street. So a very peaceful time. During the Ottoman Empire, we're actually going to be on the Rampart Walk on our first day. These walls are not during the time of Jesus' time. These were built by the Ottoman Empire, and we'll be walking on these. The other thing that occurred as Jerusalem and Ottoman started to decline was there was only about 8,000 people that were left in Jerusalem. And remember, it's 1 square mile. So you have the modern day Jerusalem, and then you have the old city that we're going to be in. Well, this is when we get the four divisions. If you remember correctly, in your binder, the first page, we talked about that the city is divided into four areas. So you had the Muslims that started to hang out where the Dome of the Rock was. And you had the Christians that started hanging out where the Church of the Sepulchre was. And you had the Jewish people would start hanging out closest to the Western Wall. And I don't know why the Armenians, because I don't know much about them, but they were hanging out near the Zion Gate. But that is where these four sections started back in this time period. And to this day, that's still how it's divided. So that's, if you ever wanted to know how that happened, that's how it happened.
What was the date of that
date? The Ottoman Empire, anywhere between 1517 to, 1517 to 1917. All right, so World War One starts, the war to end all wars starts in 1911 to 1914. And this dramatically changes the geopolitical landscape of the Middle East. This is after the war. You have the British and the French and the Russians. They start to divide this area up. And the British occupy or start to take care of, or take over modern-day Jordan, as well as what they called Palestine, which would have been Israel. You start seeing Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia and the northern countries of Africa. At least the boundaries are set up. And this is when that time period occurs. Well, Germany, who started World War One, is economically devastated, and they're defeated, and they're ordered to pay an unbelievable reparations or payments back to Europe for what they had done to start this war. Well, in January of 1919, the German Workers' Party forms, and this party advocates a range of ideas, including hostility to the conditions after World War One to their people. They were the negative nationalism because they were afraid of the moral standards of the culture that had been starting to change in the country, and they were extremely anti-Semitic. Well, on February of 24th of 1920, the German Workers' Party changes its name to the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which is more commonly what we would know as the Nazi Party. And Adolf Hitler, who was born in April 20th of 1889 in Austria, actually serves twice in the war, serves in World War One, is wounded twice in World War One, and he's in the hospital, and the second time he's wounded, and the armistice or the peace treaty is signed. And right away, he joins this party as well. And he attends his first party, the Nazi Party, of September 12th of 1919. And immediately he says, hey, listen, I'll be a part of your party, but I don't want the democratic control. I want to be the one that's in charge. And they say, nope, that's not how it's going to work. So he leaves. But the problem is they say, hey, this was one of our most charismatic leaders. If you ever listen to how he talks, he was always 20 minutes late to his speeches, and he would just be so charismatic. He would ramble at times, but he was so charismatic that people listened to him. So they say, we can't let this guy go. So they bring him back. And they agree to his terms, and he becomes the sole leader of this party. Well, he actually starts a military coup. He tries to start a military coup in November 8th of 1923, and it fails, and he's arrested, and he's put in prison. And he only serves a few months of his service because of a judge that lets him out. Well, in 1929, with Germany still in severe economic depression and widespread unemployment, the Nazis capitalize on this, and they start to win elections. In July of 1932, they gain control of the German parliament, and in 1933, Hitler is appointed German chancellor, and he is the lead of the Nazi party. And immediately, he starts to persecute Jews. April 1st, 1933, Nazi boycott all Jewish businesses begin. April 7th, the same year, the law of the restoration of the professional services begin. Jews can no longer be part of the government. They can't even be lawyers or tax collectors or even musicians. April 29th of 1933, the Gestapo or the secret police are formed. July of 1933, again, the law of the prevention of hereditary disease offspring, meaning they could sterilize anyone they felt was inferior. December 1933, Hitler, he establishes a people's court to go and start to try anyone that he felt was a political opponent of him. September 15th, the Nuremberg Laws. Jews are no longer citizens and they cannot marry anyone that's German. And then on March 12th, as the world watches and does nothing, Austria is annexed. And then, of course, in Bolden on September 1st of 1939, Hitler invades Poland and World War II in Europe begins. And shortly after Auschwitz is opened in May of 1940, there's a section in your binder about Auschwitz. Well, the Holocaust is an unprecedented time for the Jewish people. Jews had lived in Europe for more than 2,000 years. After they had the conqueror of 70 AD, the Romans took all the Jews and basically scattered them across their empire. There were still some, remember, it's very important to remember there were always Jews in Israel, even back to 2 Kings when they were exiled to Babylon. Remember, the king there left them in charge of tending the vineyards or the farm. So Jewish presence has always been there since Joshua and the people crossed Jordan River into Jericho. But they had been in Europe for about 2,000 years. And the Jewish population was about 9.5 million in 1933, which represents about 60% of the whole Jewish population of the world, which was about 15 million. Most European Jews resided in Eastern Europe, about 5.5 million of them, mostly in Poland and the Soviet Union. As the Nazis take over power in 1933, in little more than a decade, most European Jews, 2 out of every 3, would be murdered. Now, I want to make sure I let you know, as we talk through the Holocaust, I'm not going to put up any graphic images. There's a video we actually edited, but I just want to warn you that some of the things we talk about are difficult to talk about, but no pictures up there will be something that might be difficult to look at. Auschwitz was just probably one of the most infamous, I would say, pictures of it. Almost the largest mass murder site in human history. It killed anywhere between 960,000 people to 1.3 million. The most persecuted group of people besides Jews were actually gypsies. Gas chambers were their preferred execution method here. What would happen here is the Jews would come in on these trains, and it wasn't just Jews, but majority of them were, and all their belongings were taken from them. They were formed into lines. The men, the healthy men and women, might be lucky enough, quite frankly, to become workers at the camp. There were very few children. The only children that were actually left were for experiments, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And the rest of them, you know, all their jewelry were taken from them. There's stacks and stacks of shoes, leather shoes for the war effort. You could actually, they would cut their hair and they would use that for jackets and things. But they would take these people and say, hey, you need to go into these showers. And they would be taken down in the showers hundreds at a time and gassed and killed. And sometimes it would take up to 45 minutes to an hour for these people to gasp and die. And then they were taken out and they were burnt in crematoriums. And if that couldn't keep up, then they were buried in mass graves. The experiments at Auschwitz in itself, I wouldn't even like to call them doctors. They were monsters. I won't go into the graphic details, but I will just tell you, they would take men and women of different ages and children, and they'd put them in ice water to see how long they would last to survive. They would try to change the eye color of with dye. The experiments they did on children, especially twins, this one doctor, is just, he thought he could figure out if you had two twins that died the same way, like how that would... It's just gross. So I won't go into a lot of that. The death of 6 million people, excuse me, is difficult and even impossible to imagine. But here are some staggering statistics. On the eve of Germany occupied Poland in 1939, there were 3.3 million Jews in Poland. It was one of the most densely populated countries with Jewish people. At the end of the war, there were only 380,000 left in Poland. The rest had been murdered. There are about 15 million Jews today. When we're in Israel, I just want you to think about every Jewish person you see, you meet, you come in contact, just pretend they're not there. Because there's 6 million Jews in Israel today, a little over 6 million, and that's how many were killed in the Holocaust. It's difficult to comprehend those numbers. But when we see pictures like this, of course, but the next picture here, we start to put faces to these victims. This young boy here has never been identified completely. There was one man that was brought forward, and his word says, "I'm not seeking any honor." And they, you know, they take the stories. There's actually a great website that talks about some of these pictures and who has been found and whatnot. But they took the story and the time period. They actually did some facial recognition on this boy. And even though some of the stories were close and even the facial recognition was close, earlobes have a lot to do with forensics. And his are either attached or detached. I don't remember exactly. But they don't match this. So we're not sure who this boy is. And there's actually some accounts of some mothers that wrote in thinking that it was their boy. And, you know, you read through the account, you can just see they're just begging to find any connection with their child. But none of them match up. Well, this SS trooper here was identified. And I'm not going to tell you his name. But he admitted to killing 27 Jews, and in July of 29th of 1969, this 57-year-old person was executed, and rightfully so. He's buried in an unmarked grave. Some staggering statistics. There was about 200,000 perpetrators of Nazi-era crimes. After the war and all the trials that we think we know about, only 6,656 were convicted. And much of those were not executed. They were just spent some time in prison. And they're still actively looking for these people. And I hope they find every single one of them, quite frankly. I don't care how old they are. Schindler's List is probably the best film that portrays the magnitude and also the story of these individual people. If you remember the story, it's about Oscar Schindler. His grave is only about 12-minute walk from where we're going to be. I'm going to go there one morning just for historical purposes. If you'd like to join me before the tour starts, you can. But basically what it was is he was part of the Nazi party, and he realized he could profit off these Jews because it was free labor. So he would start these factories building anything from ornaments and shells to pots and pans. And his bookkeeper, though, who really made all the money for him, saw it a different way. And what he did is he started to bring people into these factories away from these death camps. And he would bring him people that he would say were essential. And Oscar Schindler, there's a part in the movie where it's a one-armed old man. And literally with hat in hand, he's thanking Oscar for allowing him to be in the factory. And Oscar could barely look at him. And he finally, when he leaves, he looks at his bookkeeper. He's like, what is this guy going to do for me? He's like, he's essential. So you begin to understand who these people were. And then later on, unfortunately, he's murdered by some SS troops in the snow. And the SS trooper that shoots him says, even more of a worthless person, an old one-armed Jew. A little boy comes in, and again, Oscar's like, what am I going to do with this guy? And he's like, oh, he's essential. He's got small fingers so he can polish the inside of the brass casings. And again, he starts bringing these people in. Well, Steven Spielberg does a fantastic job of, again, the director, of showing the magnitude of the Holocaust but personalizing it. And there's no better scene than, I think, than the girl in the red coat. And again, we edited out the one shooting scene. There is a person that gets shot far in the distance. It almost looks like they just fall over. There's not a graphic part of it. But remember this, the movie is completely filmed in black and white, except for this little girl in the red coat. And I'll show you this scene. Of the 6 million Jews killed, 1.6 million of them were estimated to be children. This scene of the girl in the red coat is actually based off of a true girl. Later on in the movie, we find that her fate, she's seen still in her red coat on a wheelbarrow as the SS exhumed their bodies to hide their atrocities. Well, the architect of the Holocaust, or the Final Solution, was named Adolf Eichmann. And after the war, he escapes to Argentina like many of the Nazi party members did. But the Mossad, or the CIA, of equivalent to us, actually hunt this man down and find him and bring him back to trial. And I wanted to read part of the account. One of the prosecutors was Gabriel Bach, and he tells the account of an interview that was done years later. Gabriel Bach still pauses to compose himself when he tells the story of the girl in the red coat. Bach, one of the three Israel prosecutors who tried the Nazi logistic director Adolf Eichmann for war crimes. Bach, who was 91 at the time of this interview, still remembers the testimony of one particular Holocaust survivor. Responding to Bach's questioning, the survivor, a Dr. Martin Foldy, describes how he was transported in a cattle car from Hungary to Auschwitz in 1944. His wife, his son, and his daughter. Upon arrival, two lines were formed, and a Nazi guard signaled for Foldy to go to the right, and for Foldy's wife, son, and daughter to go to the left. Foldy had recently bought a red coat for his daughter, who was only 2.5 years old. When Foldy looked up a few minutes later after being separated from his family, he could no longer see his wife or his son in the distance. But Bach recalls Foldy testifying he could still see that little red dot getting smaller and smaller. And this is how my family disappeared from my life. Like any good prosecutor, Bach tried to remain an unflappable demeanor. However, even in a trial that recounts horrific events, Bach said this is the only part of the testimony of the red coat that the minute of the trial that I could suddenly not utter any type of sound. And World War II ends in 1945 and 6 million Jews are dead. Again, 2 out of every 3 had been murdered. So why did God allow the Holocaust? There's another item in your binder if you'd like to read through that. And was this punishment for their sins? Well, this is not the only time that we see the world leader call for a plan, or plan the destruction of the Jewish people. If we look in the book of Esther, the Persian king actually sets a date to kill all the Jews who have been exiled there. And Esther 3:13 says, letters were sent by the couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th of the day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. What's interesting about the book of Esther is God is not mentioned one time. His name is not mentioned. There's no prayers to God. Yet we know God is obviously sovereign. We know he was active in that time period. And we know God is active in this time period as well. Well, after the end of World War II, the remaining Jews were unable or unwilling to return to Eastern Europe. And they begin to move westward toward the Allied-controlled areas. And this was the beginning of the Barha, or escape of the Jews from Europe. And in 1947, the story of a ship named the Exodus, with 4,500 Holocaust survivors, were actually turned away at the ports of Israel. But waves and waves of Jewish refugees that are being turned away trying to get them back to Israel begins to turn the public opinion to the favor of the Jewish people. And on November 29th of 1947, the newly formed nation of United Nations votes to form a two-state nation. And this is some of the maps that we'll talk about here in a second. And the Arabs reject it, and the Jews say, we'll take it. So this would have been the Jewish area in blue, and then the Arabs would have had the other shade. And actually, Jerusalem would have been a neutral ground where both could have operated in that area. Well, they reject that. So in on May 14th of 1948, Israel declares independence. And the next day, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Lebanon all attack. And the war is fought for 2 years, from 1947 to 1949. And after the war, Israel has a third more land than it had with the agreement originally. Well, the next major conflict is the Six-Day War that we might be familiar with. And this is actually where Israel attacks. He does a preemptive strike on Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. And it triples its landholding. It takes control of all the Gaza Strip. That's where Hamas is now, all the way down to Egypt, including all of the Western Bank, all of Jerusalem, and all into the Golan Heights. Takes it all. Well, between those years, the next biggest conflict is called the Yom Kippur War. And this is in October of 1973, when Egypt and Syria actually attack to take some of this land back that was lost during the Six-Day War. And a ceasefire is negotiated by the UN, and since then, we have land for peace, where Israel will give land back as long as they're assured peace. And obviously, that hasn't worked out very well for them. I will tell you this. Israel, though it's their land, and I'm clear on that, they're not innocent always with the settlements and some of the ways that they treat some of these people that are not the terrorists. So I think there's something to be said about that. In fact, when we're in Jerusalem, you'll hear that narrative as well. Well, today, Israel is a highly developed industrial economy of a GDP of about $311 billion. Its dominated sector includes high technology research facilities. Israel also is among the world leader in exporting military hardware and technology. And it's a major center for diamond cutting and pharmaceuticals. Israel is also one of the leading producers of citrus. Thanks in large part of its rich history of numerous biblical and other archaeological sites, Israel enjoys a vibrant tourist industry with about 3 million people to visit. We'll have 40 more because we're going as well. Israel is a parliamentary democracy, has a prime minister as well, and they have to have elections. It doesn't have a constitution, though. It actually is just off basic laws that they run it by. Their president or their prime minister is their leader, and then they have a Supreme Court much like we do. Well, 10 weeks ago, I told you I like completeness. I like the beginning, I like the middle, and I like an end. And Abraham was called, and God made a covenant with him to give his descendants to give him descendants and those descendants land. Moses leads God's people out of Egypt, and then Joshua leads them into the promised land. Saul and David and Solomon begin the line of kings of Israel as Israel awaits their true king promised by the prophets of God. Century after century, Israel is ruled from one empire to the next until their king is born. And this king comes not to conquer, but to serve. Jesus comes to fulfill the law, to love the lost, to conquer death through his own death on a cross, and through his resurrection. The gospel spreads across the world, and empires continue to rule Israel, but God's kingdom is being built one saved soul at a time. We Gentiles have been grafted into the olive tree of the Jewish people, and we share in their blessing. And even after God's people reject their Messiah, and Jerusalem is again destroyed in 70 AD, God has not forgotten his people. And through the events of the Holocaust, this unprecedented time of persecution, the Jews are brought back into Israel in 1948. Well, that's the beginning, and that's the middle, but the story of God's people has not ended. And Romans 11:26 says, "And in this way, all of Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will turn godlessness away from Jacob." Again, a reference to Israel. And then Revelations 1:7, "Look, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him." Again, a reference to Israel. "And all people on the earth will mourn because of him. So shall it be. Amen." So next week, come back, and we're going to end the story of Israel. Let's pray. Dear Lord, thank you for your word, Lord, and that you have not forgotten your people, and that you've provided a way for all of us, Lord, to be saved through your son, Jesus. I pray that you bless Nathaniel today as he speaks, you speak through him, Lord, and we listen and are attentive. In Jesus' name, amen.